think as long as we can focus on how rich Alaska is with our resources and our people, I think anything's possible.
Sean Parnell prepares to be governor. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 6th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a wildfire grows on the Kenai Peninsula.
It's burning in mixed fuels, but a lot of old, mature forest and dead and down and dying beetle kill primarily.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Go deep inside Alaska, where the unparalleled meets the unexpected. Fairbanks emanates a quality of light, energy, and warmth found nowhere else on Earth. It's the unexpected Alaska. Fairbanks, located right in your own backyard, is full of activities from the mild to the wild. Experience summer's land of a midnight sun in Fairbanks. Information about attractions, travel, accommodations, and more online at explorefairbanks.com. This message sponsored by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Governor Sarah Palin is keeping a low profile after announcing Friday she is resigning. On her Twitter account, Palin says she is fishing with her family in western Alaska. Palin's sudden decision has fueled speculation about motives. The FBI took the unusual step this weekend in announcing it was not investigating Palin. The last few days have been busy for Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell. He will replace her in office in less than 3 weeks and is now putting together an administration for the next year and a half that he will serve. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
No one, especially Sean Parnell, expects any major or immediate changes in the state government when Governor Palin leaves office. Parnell said that the two of them have worked together well, primarily focusing on the economy, and he and Palin have the same core values. He says he'll keep their basic philosophy of fiscal conservatism as the focus of his administration.
People are uncertain right now about the economy, about their jobs. I'm going to take steps to ensure that job creation happens, that we have a stable investment climate, and that people can be more certain about their futures. That's going to be my focus.
He says steps need to be taken now that will provide long-term economic stability in Alaska. Although he doesn't have a plan, he's ready to take a longer view, starting with his first budget and making changes that'll have an effect 10 or 20 years from now. Parnell says he learned as a legislator how to prioritize public services and live within the state's means, and that during a time that oil was selling at only $9 a barrel.
I think as long as we can focus on how rich Alaska is with our resources and our people, I think anything's possible. Oil is certainly not at all-time lows at this point. We are blessed with significant savings. You know, that's what I want to do, is manage that savings well across the years ahead to a natural gas pipeline and to other industries.
Parnell's 8-year legislative career began in 1992 when he was elected to the House of Representatives. He ended as co-chairman of the Finance Committee as a member of the Senate. He says he knows the workings of the relationship between the legislative and executive branches, and he began his preparation to become governor by putting in calls to legislative leaders, pledging to work with them.
I clearly understand the legislature's role in the appropriation and policymaking setting. I also clearly understand that the executive has a role there in terms of implementation, and it requires the branches of government to work co-equally. But also to work with dignity and respect towards each other. I'm pledging to legislators that I will treat them with dignity and respect, that I will listen to them. And I think I've demonstrated that in the past, working as part of the Palin-Parnell administration.
Parnell says he has no plans to change any cabinet-level officials at this time, although he has not met with all the commissioners because of the Independence Day holiday. However, he says he asked Mike Nizek to remain as chief of staff, and Nizek accepted, with Parnell as the 8th governor he's worked for. Parnell is comfortable with state government, and he's up to date on the issues facing the state at this time. He takes office at the governor's picnic in Fairbanks on July 26th. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
One of the strongest responses to Governor Palin's decision to resign came from Senator Lisa Murkowski. Her office put out a statement Friday night saying the senator was deeply disappointed in the governor for deciding to abandon the state and her constituents. Murkowski says after a couple days' reflection, her reaction has not changed.
I feel very strongly about my personal commitment as an elected official to the state of Alaska. And the governor's decision may be the best decision for her. I guess I remain to be convinced that it's the best decision for the state. She has a commitment to Alaska, and my statement was simply reflecting that.
Murkowski says she wants to make sure the state's pressing issues are handled well during the transition to a new governor. None of the members of Alaska's congressional delegation had a heads up that Governor Palin would announce her resignation plans, so Murkowski's staff hustled Friday to get word to the senator. She was at her family's remote cabin near Healy Lake in the interior. In order to reach her, Murkowski's staff got a radio message to someone at the lake, who then took a boat to the senator's family cabin to search for her.
They went up the slough a couple hours later and found where we were and said there's some news back home, and that was how I got it.
Murkowski says it was disconcerting because they initially thought it was an emergency situation. She said at first she was concerned that North Korea might have used the July 4th holiday to launch a missile. In order to relay a statement back to her staff, Murkowski boated to the middle of Healy Lake and used a satellite phone. She says it was definitely worth the effort since Governor Palin's decision has such a big impact on the state.
When you receive news that your state leader is stepping down, I think it warranted tracking me down and letting me know.
Senator Murkowski hasn't yet talked to Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell, but says he had reached out to her office and she expected to speak with him soon. Murkowski says she has not heard from Governor Palin. Alaska Republicans are issuing a blanket statement in the wake of Governor Palin's resignation, calling Palin a valued public servant. Although the party is trying to switch its focus toward Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell's taking the reins of government, Palin's abrupt departure leaves some lead Republicans a bit at sea. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
In a statement issued on the Alaska Republicans' website on Friday, party officials praise Palin's ability to put Alaska in a national spotlight while admitting party feelings are mixed.
I was doing other things and suddenly had to shift gears and come to the office on Friday.
Randy Redrick, chairman of the Alaska Republican Party, admits he was taken off guard.
And when someone called me early Friday morning saying she's resigning, I said, no, I can't believe that. And of course, a few minutes later, I was... so much for not knowing what's going on at all.
On a serious level, Palin's defection from state government leaves the party somewhat in the lurch. Redrick says on the upside, a door is open for strong Republican gubernatorial candidates.
I think there have been a number of folks rumored, and for fear of leaving out somebody who might be a real candidate, I don't think I'll speculate on a list, but I would expect that we'll have at least three or four folks wage meaningful campaigns for a vacant Republican nomination.
He says it promises to be a vigorous race and that the party will support a conservative candidate. As far as Palin is concerned, he says if her path leads to a run for national office, the party will support her.
Because drill, baby, drill, it was really a good idea, and it's still a good idea. And it'd be great to have Governor Palin out there representing Alaska interest on energy development.
That is, once they get over the initial shock of Palin's abrupt abdication.
I was looking forward to a decision on whether or not she was running for governor so that we'd have an opportunity, if she wasn't running, for other folks to engage in. But the not running and stepping down was a great surprise to me.
He says he never saw it coming. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, evidence that rewrites the Ice Age history of Alaska.
We were looking at buried glacial ice, and that was the smoking gun that we were looking for.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
two Fort Richardson paratroopers were killed in Afghanistan on Saturday. Private First Class Justin Casillas and Aaron Fairbairn were killed on July 4th when a combat outpost in eastern Afghanistan came under attack. 13 other soldiers were also injured. Justin Casillas was a 19-year-old infantryman from California who joined the Army a year ago. Aaron Fairbairn was a 20-year-old from Washington State. Both men were assigned to the 3rd Battalion, 509th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 4th Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division. They deployed to Afghanistan with the unit in February 2009. Next of kin have been notified. The Kenai National Wildlife Refuge continues to monitor a wildfire that was started by lightning last week and is now burning more than 700 acres. Refuge manager Robin West says the Shanta Creek fire that's been burning north of Tustamina Lake appeared to be slowly dying out late last week. On Friday, it was only about a third of an acre, but dry, windy conditions over the weekend caused it to grow quickly Saturday and Sunday. Fortunately, West says it is moving in an easterly direction, away from civilization.
It's burning in mixed fuels, but a lot of old mature forest and dead and down and dying beetle kill primarily. So it's doing good things, except it's putting a lot of smoke in the air, and it's probably going to continue to do that with this weather pattern for a while. Good news is the winds are pushing it well away from any habitation.
Dozens of wildfires are also burning in the interior as hot, dry weather continues. 61 fires were reported as of today, but just 7 were staffed, primarily to protect isolated cabins and native allotments. Although the blazes are far from populated areas, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation meteorologist Cindy Detmer-Shea says smoke from the fires is spreading over a much broader region.
All the way down to Anchorage. You can see it. However, it's not impacting the ground, the area where we're at, which is more what we're concerned with here at DEC. Our concern is air quality at the surface, and mostly this is going to be closer to the fires. There's a group of fires burning north of Denali, so the smoke that you guys are seeing in Fairbanks, they're caused by that. There's some visibility reports that are in the 1 to 3 mile visibility range around Healy and Cantwell.
Detmer-Shea says there's also a fire burning in the Copper River Basin that's sending smoke across communities in that area. The smoke has prompted air quality advisories, including in Fairbanks, where conditions are described as unhealthy for sensitive groups like children, the sick, and the elderly. State federal wildlife agencies normally downgrade suppression operations after July 10th in anticipation of cooler, wetter conditions. Alaska Fire Service spokesman Doug Stockdale says it's unclear at this point if that's going to happen this summer.
We have not made that decision yet. We're still looking at the conditions, and right now we're getting hot and dry, and the fires are becoming more active. Many of these fires had started before, and they died down for a little while. They were still burning, however, and with the shift in the conditions, they kind of flared back up.
350 wildfires have consumed 486,000 acres in Alaska so far this summer. Stockdale says this summer's totals are about average, but well ahead of fire activity in the lower 48, which has been very low so far. A bill before Congress would clarify exactly what kind of industries can dump material into a body of water. The Clean Water Protection Act would differentiate between fill and waste. Its supporters hope it would prevent mining companies, coal-fired power plants, and industrial farms from dumping their waste into waterways. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, it would affect permits for businesses like the Kensington Mine in southeast Alaska.
When the U.S. Supreme Court ruled recently that the Kensington Gold Mine near Juneau can dump tailings into a lake, it determined mining waste to be fill material, not a pollutant. The court said the slurry mixture of rock and water is correctly permitted by the Army Corps of Engineers. Environmental groups had argued that it should be up to the Environmental Protection Agency to authorize any discharge into the lake, but the justices disagreed. That set off alarms among conservationists. Earth Justice attorney Tom Waldo says mine waste deposited into lakes will kill fish and other aquatic life, so the EPA should regulate it. Waldo argued the Kensington case before the Supreme Court and says now other companies may look for ways around the EPA's rules.
I think one result of this decision is you'll see corporations in other manufacturing industries saying, hey, we want a fill material permit for our discharge because it gets them out from having to comply with these strict EPA rules that are designed to protect water quality. That's a significant concern.
Waldo says industries like aluminum smelters, cement and battery manufacturing plants, and large farming operations all generate solid waste that they can call fill. He hopes either Congress or the federal agencies that regulate pollution will tighten the definition of exactly what fill material is.
The Clean Water Act currently does not define fill material, and that was one of the problems that led to the decision in this case. It left a lot of leeway to the agencies. It's also possible for the agencies to correct this problem through their regulations defining fill material.
The Clean Water Protection Act, now before Congress, defines fill as material that's put into water bodies and changes their elevation, things like sand, rock, or gravel. But it says fill is not a pollutant discharged into the water primarily to dispose of waste, so the act would make it illegal to dump waste into water. The bill's main sponsor is New Jersey Democrat Frank Pallone. 152 others, including some Republicans, have signed on to it. Congressman Pallone says, bottom line, pollutants should not be dumped into waterways.
Basically, the Army Corps is allowing, you know, waste material from gold mining or mountaintop removal, you know, to be thrown into streams, and a lot of that material is toxic and it really is destroying the landscape and the water. I just think it's a total corruption of what was anticipated in the Clean Water Act, you know, by Congress.
Pallone hopes to schedule a House subcommittee hearing on the bill later this year. His East Coast district does not have mining like Alaska, but he's pushing the issue because of what he's seen at home.
In my district, it comes into play because we've had a history of dumping of material in the ocean. And so, you know, we've taken a position that the Corps' dumping of a toxic material in the ocean is not allowed either under the Clean Water Act. So it's similar.
Pallone introduced the Clean Water Protection Act in the last Congress, and similar bills have come up in past years. With the strong Democratic presence on Capitol Hill and in the White House, it now has a better chance of passage. Alaska's Congressman Don Young opposes the bill. So do other congressmen from heavy industry parts of the country. Young doubts it will go anywhere. And even if it does, Young says it would not affect the Kensington mine.
I don't believe it will become law. Any previous permits issued would be, in fact, valid.
Young says he thinks fill material rules are clear enough and says the whole issue is being blown out of proportion.
Is a fill waste? This is what people don't understand. You know, Juneau's built on tailings. So is it built on waste or is it a viable product? You know?
Kensington mine owner Core Alaska says it hopes to start construction of the tailings dump this summer. Unless the Obama administration moves to block the Army Corps of Engineers permit, Core says the mine could produce gold by the middle of 2010. With help from Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, I'm Libby Casey in Washington.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
The ice age must have been icier than we thought, at least in Alaska. A new find by permafrost scientists on the North Slope is likely to redraw the map of where the ice was 10 to 30,000 years ago. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
We know from the remains of their fires and tool making that 11,000 years ago, big game hunters used to sit on a mesa north of the Brooks Range and watch for caribou on the land below. And it's only in these upper elevations that the fossil bones of Ice Age animals are found.
It's odd that it would be up in the foothills and not down along the coast.
But what if it wasn't a coast, but a glacier 11,000 years ago? Tor Jorgensen is part of a team of University of Alaska Fairbanks scientists that has found what they're sure is a piece of that glacier still preserved in the permafrost. The piece was exposed by a coastal storm last summer on the coast of Barter Island in the village of Kaktovik. In one of science's great coincidences, this happened at the moment when the scientists most qualified to identify it were in the village, waiting for the weather to clear for a flight out to nearby areas where they've felt for years that there are many features of the landscape that could only be explained by the presence of an ancient ice sheet extending as far as 50 miles inland. UAF permafrost scientist Yuri Schur says while they were waiting, Jorgensen decided to check to see if some instruments he'd placed along the shore in Kaktovik had made it through the storm.
Thor ran to check his equipment along the shore, and we came later, and he bring this piece of ice and said, Yuri, look what we have here.
This glacier piece they call basal ice is not exactly a pretty sight, unless you're a glacier scientist. Maybe you would even have to be a Russian glacier scientist. It's black and convoluted, as might be expected from ice on the bottom of a glacier that's ground up a lot of rock and dirt. It's not the sort of nice white and even clear ice wedges you see in typical permafrost.
It's completely different. There is no other ice in permafrost which looks like basal ice.
They were able to identify this basal ice because they'd been learning what it looked like all over Alaska. A third permafrost researcher, Mikhail Kanievsky, had found it at the end of the Matanuska and Muldrow glaciers elsewhere in the state, as well as other places.
He was able to bring that experience and confirm that we were looking at buried glacial ice, and that was the smoking gun that we were looking for to allow us to have confidence to come out with multiple lines of evidence for glaciation of the coastal plain in northern Alaska.
The other evidence includes the ground itself along that part of the North Slope and also offshore. The sediments there are compressed as if they'd been under a great weight, and under a microscope they show the wear of a glacier. All of this was written up into a poster presentation for last fall's meeting of the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco. Not many people noticed it. The rest of the scientific world is still hesitant to embrace this radically new map of the late Pleistocene. After the basal ice was sampled and mapped, it was washed away in subsequent storms. It will take time to date the samples, but one scientist who welcomes the find is Leonid Polyak, another Russian transplant who is curator of an Ohio State University repository of sediment cores drilled from the seafloor. Polyak has found what he thinks are underwater ridges left by glaciers under the waters offshore from Barter Island and even as far west as the Chukchi Sea.
Even without a date, just the fact that there is really a remnant of a glacier ice would confirm that there was, at least at some point in the Pleistocene, those were the extension of ice sheets from the Laurentide onto the Alaskan margin. So that would confirm our conclusions and help us to have a better feeling of what was the extent of that ice.
Polyak's paper was also published last year. Yuri Schur says he himself was hesitant to accept the theory that this flattened-out land had been crushed under a glacier. He first saw such land in the Russian far north almost 30 years ago, but he didn't know what he was seeing. Now it seems obvious to him.
That's when you start to collect data, you are surprised why it was missing these links of glaciation, because tiny pieces from different directions comes to the same place.
Tor Jorgensen says the find will likely overturn some pretty fundamental assumptions about what the environment of the Ice Age was like. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
It's been a pretty good king salmon run on the lower Kuskokwim River this year, but escapement in the mid-river tributaries is not so impressive. Some are starting to wonder what's happening to the kings between the Kuskokwim Bay and the Kuskokwim tributaries. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
For weeks now, residents in the village of Aniak have been anxious to complete their subsistence fishing for the season. According to Aniak resident Calvin Simeon, most families have now done that.
And there's about five families that I could see that are still fishing.
Simeon was speaking during the Kuskokwim Salmon Working Group meeting held earlier this week. But Simeon also said that the fishing experience in Aniak was different from those downriver.
I'd say the majority of people I spoke to were
really, really concerned about having to fish so hard for so few fish.
Figures from the Alaska Fish and Game Test Fishery show that the King Run near Bethel has been adequate, but it is slowing, says Doug Bew.
It looks like the majority of the Chinook salmon are past the Bethel test fishery.
And while many of those fish are still traveling the Kuskokwim, the front end should be reaching fish weirs in Kuskokwim tributaries. Fish and Game has weirs in rivers like the Tuluksac and Kugrugaluk. So far, the numbers of kings passing those weirs are not reflecting the good run lower river fishers have seen. Chris Sheldon monitors the weirs for Fish and Game. He said kings are yet to show up in satisfactory numbers.
They're lagging well behind most years at assessment projects. And we're looking at a year of low abundance, at least as far as these numbers show.
There's still time for those numbers to turn around, but Calvin Simeon of Aniak said from his experience in the mid-river, he doesn't see that happening.
I just have a bad feeling about it.
The Kuskokwim Salmon Working Group discussed what could account for that disparity. Doug Mulineaux, a fish and game biologist, says that subsistence catches of kings are increasing.
Of Chinook salmon seem to be coming up, and that seems to be the one factor that's standing out as being different this year.
Simeon is the mid-river representative. He has been concerned with increasing subsistence catches downriver, but he says that's not the problem this year.
The fact of the matter is that we have had 3 commercial openings during the peak of the King Run in Bethel.
The last commercial opening, fishers hauled in about 770 kings, but for the whole commercial season, the total is more like 7,100. That's about 7 to 9% the amount of kings subsistence users harvest, and Fish and Game says 6-inch gear restrictions limit the amount of big females caught. In the first opening, 87% of the kings were males, and it was 75% for the second opening. But Simeon says even the kings that escape can still be affected by the volume of nets during commercial periods.
A lot of those larger kings that drop out, they die or they don't make it, or their outer skin is, the meniscus layer is so taken off of them that I don't know if they can survive all the way up here.
There is some reason to be hopeful that the numbers could still pick up. Another Aniak resident, Dave Cannon, said that the run could be strengthening there.
It seems that the large female kings have just really showed up in decent numbers.
Coastal Villages Seafood is the only large buyer on the river. They're holding off on any commercial openings now. Stuart Curry cited weather concerns as the main issue, but he said the weir reports also affected their decision.
Obviously concerned about the King Run and the return, so at this point it wouldn't hurt to err on the side of being conservative.
Fish and Game says despite the disappointing early numbers, most weirs are still on target to meet the lower end of escapement goals. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Shane Iverson in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others claiming the Society of Jesus, Oregon Providence, has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus, Oregon Providence.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.